silence. Most often these dialogues took only a few minutes, but by the end of September, there'd already been two occasions when they'd lasted more than 3/4 of an hour. I was constantly being reminded by these dialogues of the way Danny argued Talmud with his father. It made it not only difficult to forget him, but quite impossible. And now it was also I, and not only Reb Saunders, who was able to listen to Danny's voice only through a Talmudic disputation. The hours of the Talmud classes in the school were arranged in such a way that we were able to spend from 9 in the morning to noon preparing the material to be studied with Rob Gershenson. We would then eat lunch. And from 1 to 3, we would have the actual Talmud session itself, the shiur with Rob Gershenson. No one in the class knew who'd be called on to read and explain, so all of us worked feverishly to prepare. But it never really helped, because no matter how hard we worked, there would always be that dreaded moment of silence when the questions could no longer be answered and Rob Gershenson's fingers would begin their drumming. There were 14 students in the class, and each one of us, with the exception of Danny, sooner or later tasted that silence personally. I was called on in the first week of October, and tasted the silence briefly before I managed to struggle through with an answer to an almost impossible question. The answer was accepted and amplified by Rob Gershenson, thereby forestalling Danny's poised hand. I saw him look at me briefly afterward, while Rob Gershenson dealt with my answer. Then he looked away, and a warm smile played on his lips. My anger at him melted away at the sight of that smile, and the agony of not being able to communicate with him returned. But it was a subdued agony now, a sore I was somehow able to control and keep within limits. It was no longer affecting my schoolwork. By the middle of October, everyone in the class, except me, had been called on at least twice. I prepared feverishly, expecting to hear my name called any day, but it wasn't. By the end of October, I began to feel uneasy. By the middle of November, I still hadn't been called on again. I took part in the class discussions, asked questions, argued, raised my hand almost as frequently as Danny raised his in response to Rav Gershenson's Who Does Know? But I wasn't called on to read. I couldn't understand it, and it began to upset me. I wondered if this was his way of participating in Reb Saunders' ban against me and my father. There were other things, too, that were upsetting me at the time. My father had begun to look almost skeletal as a result of his activities, and I dreaded the nights he came wearily home, drank his glass of tea, spent some minutes with me in my room, looking hollow-eyed and not really listening to what I told him, and then went into his study. Instead of studying Talmud with him on the Shabbat, I studied alone while he slept. The Palestine issue was being debated now by the United Nations, and the partition plan would soon be voted upon. Every day there were headlines announcing new acts of terror and bloodshed. Every week, it seemed, there was another massive rally in Madison Square Garden. I was able to attend two of those rallies. The second time I went, I made sure to arrive early enough to get a seat inside. The speeches were electrifying, and I joined in the applause and the cheering until my hands were sore and my voice was hoarse. My father spoke at that rally, his voice booming out clearly through the public address system. He seemed so huge behind the microphones, his voice giving his body the stature of a giant. When he was done, I sat and listened to the wild applause of the crowd, and my eyes filled with tears of pride. In the midst of all this, Reb Saunders' League for a Religious Eretz Yisroel continued putting out its anti-Zionist leaflets. Everywhere I went, I found those leaflets. On the streets, in the trolley cars, in my classroom desks, on my lunch table, even in the school bathrooms. It became clear, as November went by, that the United Nations vote on the partition plan would take place sometime at the end of the month. My father was at a meeting on Saturday evening, November 29th, when the vote was finally held, and I listened to it over the kitchen radio. I cried like a baby when the result was announced, and later, when my father came home, we embraced and wept and kissed, and our tears mingled on our cheeks. He was almost incoherent with joy. The death of the 6 million Jews had finally been given meaning, he kept saying over and over again. It had happened. After 2,000 years, it had finally happened. We were a people again, with our own land. We were a blessed generation. We'd been given the opportunity to see the creation of the Jewish state. Thank God, he said. Thank God. Thank God. We alternately wept and talked until after 3 in the morning, when we finally went to bed. I woke groggy from lack of sleep, but still feeling the sense of exhilaration, and was eager to get to school to share the joy with my friends. My exhilaration was dampened somewhat during breakfast, when my father and I heard over the radio that a few hours after the United Nations vote, a bus on its way from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem had been attacked by Arabs, and 7 Jews had been killed. And my exhilaration was snuffed out and transformed into an almost uncontrollable rage when I got to school and found it strewn with the leaflets of Reb Saunders' Anti-Zionist League. The leaflets denounced the United Nations vote, ordered Jews to ignore it, called the state a desecration of the name of God, and announced that the League planned to fight its recognition by the government of the United States. Only the dean's threat of immediate expulsion prevented me from engaging in a fistfight that day. I was tempted more than once to scream at the groups of anti-Zionist students huddling together in the halls and classrooms that they ought to go join the Arabs and the British if they were so opposed to the Jewish state. But I managed somehow to control myself and remain silent. In subsequent weeks, I was grateful for that silence. For as Arab forces began to attack the Jewish communities of Palestine, as an Arab mob surged through Princess Mary Avenue in Jerusalem, wrecking and gutting shops and leaving the old Jewish commercial center looted and burned, and as the toll of Jewish dead increased daily, Reb Saunders' League grew strangely silent. The faces of the anti-Zionist Hasidic students in the school became tense and pained, and all anti-Zionist talk ceased. I watched them every day at lunch as they read to each other the accounts of the bloodshed reported in the Jewish press, and then talked about it among themselves. I could hear sighs, see heads shaking and eyes filling with sadness. "Again Jewish blood is being spilled," they whispered to one another. "Hitler wasn't enough? Now more Jewish blood? More slaughter? What does the world want from us? 6 million isn't enough? More Jews have to die?" Their pain over this new outbreak of violence against the Jews of Palestine outweighed their hatred of Zionism. They didn't become Zionists. They merely became silent. I was glad during those weeks that I had restrained my anger. I received straight A's in my college courses at the end of that semester. I also received an A in Talmud, despite the fact that Rav Gershenson had only called on me once during the entire 4-month period I'd spent in his class. I planned to talk to him about it during the intersemester break, but my father suffered a second heart attack on the first day of that break. He collapsed at a Jewish National Fund meeting and was rushed to the Brooklyn Memorial Hospital by ambulance. He hovered tenuously between life and death for 3 days. I lived in a nightmare of hallucinatory dread, and if it hadn't been for Manya constantly reminding me with gentle kindness that I had to eat, or I'd get sick, I might well have starved. My father was beginning to recover when the second semester began, but he was a shell of a man. Dr. Grossman told me that he'd be in the hospital at least 6 weeks, and that it would take from 4 to 6 more months of complete rest before he would be able to return to his work. My classmates had all heard the news by the time the semester began, but their words of consolation didn't help very much. The look on Danny's face, though, when I saw him for the first time, helped a little. He passed me in the hallway, his face a suffering mask of pain and compassion. I thought for a moment he would speak to me, but he didn't. Instead, he brushed against me and managed to touch my hand for a second. His touch and his eyes spoke the words that his lips couldn't. I told myself it was bitter and ironic that my father needed to have a heart attack in order for some contact to be established once again between myself and Danny. I lived alone. Manya came in the mornings and left after supper, and during the long winter nights of January and February, I was all alone in the house. I'd been alone before, but the knowledge that my father would return from his meetings and spend a few minutes with me had made the loneliness endurable. Now he wasn't attending meetings and wasn't coming into my room, and for the first few days the total silence inside the apartment was impossible for me to take, and I would go out of the house and take long walks in the bitter cold winter nights. But my schoolwork began to suffer, and I finally took hold of myself. I spent as much of the early parts of every evening as I could visiting my father in the hospital. He was weak and could barely talk, and kept asking me if I was taking care of myself. Dr. Grossman had warned me not to tire him, so I left as soon as I could, went home, ate, then spent the night studying. By the time my father had been in the hospital 3 weeks, the evenings had become almost an automatic routine. The dread of his possible death was gone. It was now a matter of waiting out the silence until he came home. And I waited out the silence by studying. I began especially to study Talmud. In the past, I'd done all my Talmud studying on Shabbat and during the morning preparation periods. Now I began to study Talmud in the evenings as well. I tried to finish my college work as quickly as I could, then I turned to the passage of Talmud we were studying with Rav Gershenson. I would study it carefully, memorize it, find the various commentaries, those which were not printed in the Talmud itself could always be found in my father's library, and memorize them. I tried to anticipate Rav Gershenson's tangled questions. And then I began to do something I'd never done before with the Talmud I studied in school. After I was done memorizing the text and the commentaries, I began to go over the text again critically. I checked the Talmudic cross-references for parallel texts and memorized whatever differences I found. I took the huge volumes of the Palestinian Talmud from my father's library, the text we studied in school was the Babylonian Talmud, and checked its parallel discussions just to see how it differed from the discussions in the Babylonian Talmud. I worked carefully and methodically, using everything my father had taught me and a lot of things I now was able to teach myself. I was able to do all of this in real depth because of Rob Gershenson's slow-paced method of teaching. And by doing all of this, I was able to anticipate most of Rob Gershenson's questions. I also became more and more certain of when he would call on me again. He'd never called on me since that day in October, and it was now the middle of February. As a result of my night sessions with Talmud, I'd pulled ahead of the class by at least 5 or 6 days and was tangled in one of the most complicated discussions I'd ever encountered. The complication was caused not only by the Talmud text itself, which seemed filled with gaps, but by the commentaries that struggled to explain it. The text consisted of 9 lines. One of the commentaries on the text ran to 2.5 pages. Another ran to 4 pages. Neither was very clear. A third commentary, however, explained the text in 6 lines. The explanation was terse, clipped, and simple. The only thing wrong with it was that it seemed not to be based on the text it was explaining. A later commentary tried to reconcile the 3 commentaries by the method of Pilpul, the result being a happy one for someone who enjoyed Pilpul, but quite strained as far as I was concerned. It looked to be a hopeless situation. As we came closer and closer to this text, I became more and more convinced that Rav Gershenson was going to call on me to read and explain it. I didn't quite know why I was convinced of that. I just knew that I was. I began painfully to unravel the puzzle. I did it in 2 ways. First, in the traditional way, by memorizing the text and the commentaries, and then inventing all sorts of questions that Rav Gershenson might ask me. I would ride the trolley, walk the streets, or lie in bed and ask myself questions. Second, in the way my father had taught me, By attempting to find or reconstruct the correct text, the text the commentator, who had offered the simple explanation, must have had before him. The first way was relatively simple. It was a matter of brute memorization. The second way was tortuous. I searched endlessly through all the cross-references and all the parallel passages in the Palestinian Talmud. When I was done, I had 4 different versions of the text on my hands. I now had to reconstruct the text upon which the simple commentary had been based. I did it by working backward, using the commentary as a base, then asking myself what passage among the 4 versions the commentator could have had before him as he wrote the commentary. It was painstaking work, but I finally thought I had it down right. It had taken hours and hours of precious time, but I was satisfied I had the correct text, the only text that really made sense. I'd done it this way only to satisfy myself. When Rav Gershenson called on me, I would, of course, only use the first method of explanation. When my father returned from the hospital, I would show him what I'd done with the second method. I felt very proud of my accomplishment. 3 days later, we came to that passage in our Talmud class, and for the second time that year, Rav Gershenson called out my name and asked me to read and explain. The class was deathly silent. Some of my friends had told me earlier that they dreaded being called on for that passage. They hadn't been able to make any sense at all out of it, and the commentaries were impossible. I was a little frightened too, but very eager to show off what I'd learned. When I heard my name called, I felt myself tingle with a mixture of fear and excitement, as if a tiny electric shock had gone through my body. Most of the students had been waiting apprehensively to hear who would be asked to read. They had sat staring down at their texts, afraid to meet Rav Gershenson's eyes. Now they were all looking at me. Even Danny was looking at me, and from one of the students at my right came a barely audible sigh of relief. I bent over my Talmud, put the index finger of my right hand below the first word of the passage, and began to read. Every Talmudic passage is composed of what, for the sake of convenience, might best be called thought units. Each thought unit is a separate stage of the total discussion that makes up the passage. It might consist of a terse statement of law, or a question on the statement, an answer to the question, a brief or lengthy commentary on a biblical verse, and so on. The Talmud contains no punctuation marks, and it isn't always a simple matter to determine where a thought unit begins and ends. Occasionally, a passage will have a tight organic flow to it, which makes breaking it up into thought units difficult and somewhat arbitrary. In most instances, however, the thought units are clearly discernible, and the decision on how to break up a passage into such units is a matter of common sense and a feel for the rhythm of the argument. The need to break up a passage into its thought units is simple enough. One has to decide when to stop reading and start explaining, as well as when to appeal to the commentaries for further explanation. I had broken up the passage into its thought units as I studied it, so I knew precisely at what points I would stop reading and begin my explanations. I read aloud a thought unit that consisted of a citation from the Mishnah. The Mishnah is the written text of rabbinic oral law. In form and content, it's for the most part terse and clipped, a vast collection of laws upon which are based almost all the rabbinic discussions, which together with the Mishnah, composed the Talmud. When I came to the end of the Mishnaic thought unit, I stopped and reviewed it briefly, together with the commentaries of Rashi and the Tosafists. I tried to be as clear as I could, and acted as if I myself were teaching the class, rather than merely acting as a springboard for Rav Gershenson's comments. I finished the explanation of the Mishnaic text and read the next thought unit, which consisted of another Mishnah found in a different tractate from the one we were now studying. The second Mishnah flatly contradicted the first. I explained the Mishnah carefully, showed why there was a contradiction, then read from the commentaries of Rashi and the Tosafists, both of which are printed on the same page as the Talmud text. I expected to be stopped at any moment by Rav Gershenson, but nothing happened. I continued reading and explaining, my eyes fixed on the text as I read and looking at Rav Gershenson as I explained. He let me continue without interruption. By the time I was four lines into the passage, the discussion had become so involved that I'd already begun to appeal to one of the medieval commentaries that were not printed on the same page as the text, but were rather placed separately at the end of the tractate. I kept a finger of my right hand on the appropriate place in the text, flipped the Talmud to where the commentary had been printed, and read from it. I then indicated that other commentaries had offered different explanations, and I cited them by heart because they weren't found in the Talmud edition the class used. Having said that, I returned to the passage and continued to read. When I raised my eyes to explain the thought unit I had just read, I saw that Rav Gershenson had sat down, the first time since I'd come into the class that he was sitting during a shiur. He was holding his head in the palms of his hands, the elbows on the open Talmud in front of him, and listening intently. As I continued with my explanation of the thought unit I'd just read, I glanced at my wristwatch and discovered, to my amazement, that I'd been talking for almost an hour and a half without interruption. I had to utilize all the commentaries this time and was able to finish explaining the thought unit a moment before the 3 o'clock bell sounded. Rav Gershenson said nothing. He just sat there and dismissed the class with a wave of his hand. The next day, he called on me again, and I continued to read and explain. I spent 2 hours on 7 words, and again, sometime during the session, he sat down with his head in the palms of his hands. He said not a single word. The bell caught me in the middle of a lengthy explanation of the 4-page commentary, and when he called on me again the third day, I read the 7 words quickly, briefly went through my explanations of the day before, then continued where I'd stopped. Between the third and fourth day, my mood jumped back and forth erratically, from wild exhilaration to gloomy apprehension. I knew I was doing well, otherwise Rav Gershenson would have stopped me, but I kept wishing he would say something and not just stand or sit in complete silence. Some of the Hasidic students in the class were giving me mixed looks of awe and jealousy, as if they couldn't restrain their feelings of admiration over how well I was doing, but at the same time were asking themselves how someone like me, a Zionist, and the son of a man who wrote Apokorsische articles, could possibly know Talmud so well. Danny, though, seemed absolutely delighted over what was happening. He never looked at me while I read and explained, but I could see him nodding his head and smiling as I went through my explanations. And Rav Gershenson remained silent and impassive, listening intently, his face expressionless, except for an occasional upward curving along the corners of his lips whenever I clarified a particularly difficult point. By the end of the third day, it began to be something of a frustrating experience. I wished he would at least say or do something, nod his head, smile, even catch me at a mistake. Anything but that awful silence. I was prepared for Rav Gershenson to call on me again the fourth day, and he did. There was by now only one more thought unit left in the passage, and I decided in advance that when I was done explaining it, I would quickly review the entire passage and all the commentaries, outlining the difficulties they'd found in the text, and showing the different ways they'd explain these difficulties. Then I would go into the attempt of the late medieval commentary to reconcile the diverse explanations of the commentaries. All of that took me just under an hour, and when I was satisfied that I'd done the best I could, I stopped talking. Rav Gershenson was sitting behind his desk, looking at me intently. It felt strange to me for a moment not to be hearing my own voice anymore, but I had nothing more to say. There was a brief silence, during which I saw one of the Hasidic students grin and lean over to whisper something into another Hasidic student's ear. Then Rav Gershenson got to his feet and folded his arms across his chest. He was smiling a little now, and the upper part of his body was swaying slowly back and forth. He asked me to repeat a point I'd made 2 days earlier, and I did. He asked me to make myself a little clearer on a passage in one of the commentaries, and I repeated the passage by heart and explained it again as best I could. He asked me to go over the difficulties I'd found in the various commentaries, and I repeated them carefully. Then he asked me to show how the late medieval commentary had attempted to reconcile these difficulties, and I went over that too. Again, there was a brief silence. I glanced at my watch and saw it was 2:30. I wondered if he would start on the next passage with only half an hour left to the shiur. He usually preferred to start a new passage, or inyan as it is called, at the beginning of a shiur, so as to give the class time to get into it. I was feeling very satisfied with the way I'd explained the passage and answered his questions. I promised myself that I would tell my father about it when I visited him in the hospital that evening. Then I heard Rav Gershenson ask me whether I was satisfied with the late medieval commentary's attempt at reconciliation. It was a question I hadn't expected. I'd regarded the effort at reconciliation as the rock bottom of the entire discussion on the passage, and had never thought that Rav Gershenson would question it. For a long moment, I felt myself wallowing in that dreaded silence that always followed a question of his that a student couldn't answer, and I waited for the drumming of his fingers to begin. But his arms remained folded across his chest, and he stood there, swaying slowly back and forth and looking at me intently. "No," he said again. "There are no questions about what he says?" I waited for Danny's hand to go up, but it didn't. I glanced at him and saw his mouth had fallen slightly open. The question had caught him by surprise, too. Rav Gershenson stroked his pointed beard with his right hand, then asked me for the third time if I was satisfied with what the commentary said. I heard myself tell him that I wasn't.
"Ah," he said, smiling faintly. "Good. And why not?"
"Because it's Pilpul," I heard myself say. There was a stir from the class. I saw Danny stiffen in his seat, throw me a quick, almost fearful glance, then look away. I was suddenly a little frightened at the disparaging way I'd uttered the word Pilpul. The tone of disapproval in my voice hung in the air of the classroom like a threat. Rav Gershenson slowly stroked his pointed gray beard.
"So," he said softly, "it is Pilpul. I see you do not like Pilpul."
"No. The great Vilna Gaon also did not like Pilpul."
He was talking about Rabbi Elijah of Vilna, the 18th century opponent of Hasidism.
"Tell me, Reuven."
That was the first time he'd ever called me by my first name.
"Why is it Pilpul? What is wrong with his explanation?"
I answered that it was strained, that it attributed nuances to the various conflicting commentaries that were not there, and that therefore it really wasn't a reconciliation at all. He nodded his head slowly.
"No,"
he said, not speaking only to me, but to the entire class now.
"It is a very difficult inyan. And the commentaries..."
He used the term Rishonim, which indicates the early medieval Talmudic commentators.
"Do not help us."
Then he looked at me.
"Tell me, Reuven," he said quietly, "how do you explain the inyan?"
I sat there and stared at him in stunned silence. If the commentators hadn't been able to explain it, how could I? But he didn't let the silence continue this time. Instead, he repeated his question, his voice soft, gentle.
"You cannot explain it, Reuven?"
"No," I heard myself say.
"So,
Rav Gershenson said,
"You cannot explain it."
"You are sure you cannot explain it?"
For a moment, I was almost tempted to tell him the text was wrong and to give him the text I had reconstructed. But I didn't. I was afraid. I remembered Danny telling me that Rav Gershenson knew all about the critical method of studying Talmud and hated it. So I kept silent. Rav Gershenson turned to the class.
"Can anyone explain the Inyan?"
he asked quietly. He was answered by silence. He sighed loudly.
"No," he said. "No one can explain it. The truth is, I cannot explain it myself. It is a difficult Inyan, a very difficult Inyan."
He was silent for a moment, then he shook his head and smiled.
"A teacher can also sometimes not know," he said softly.
That was the first time in my life I had ever heard a rabbi admit that he didn't understand a passage of Talmud. We sat there in an uncomfortable silence. Rav Gershenson stared down at the open Talmud on his desk. Then he closed it slowly and dismissed the class. As I was gathering up my books, I heard him call my name. Danny heard him too and looked at him.
"I want to talk with you a minute,"
Rav Gershenson said. I went up to his desk. Standing near him, I could see how wrinkled his face and brow were. The skin on his hands looked dry, parchment-like, and his lips formed a thin line beneath the heavy tangle of gray beard. His eyes were brown and gentle, and deep wrinkles spread from their outside corners like tiny furrows. He waited until all the students were out of the classroom. Then he asked me quietly,
"You studied the Inyan by yourself, Reuven?"
"Yes," I said.
"Your father did not help you?"
"My father's in the hospital." He looked shocked. "He's better now. He had a heart attack."
"I did not know," he said softly. "I'm sorry to hear that."
He paused for a moment, looking at me intently.
"So," he said, "you studied the Inyan alone?"
I nodded.
"Tell me, Reuven," he said gently, "do you study Talmud with your father?"
"Yes," I said.
"Your father is a great scholar,"
he said quietly, almost wistfully.
"A very great scholar."
His brown eyes seemed misty.
"Reuven, tell me, how would your father have answered my question?"
I stared at him and didn't know what to say. He smiled faintly, apologetically.
"You do not know how your father would have explained the Inyan?"
The class was gone. We were alone, and somehow I felt an intimacy between us that made it not too difficult for me to say what I then said. I didn't say it without feeling a little frightened, though.
"I think I know what he would have said."
"No?"
Rav Gershenson prodded me gently.
"What?"
"I think he would have said the text is wrong." I saw him blink his eyes a few times, his face expressionless.
"Explain what you mean,"
he said quietly. I explained how I had reconstructed the text, then quoted the reconstructed text from memory, showing him how it fitted perfectly to the explanation offered by the simplest of all the commentaries. I ended by saying I felt certain that was the text of the Talmud manuscript the commentator had had before him when he'd written his commentary. Rav Gershenson was silent for a long moment, his face impassive. Then he said slowly,
"You did this by yourself, Reuven?"
"Yes."
"Your father is a good teacher,"
he told me quietly.
You are blessed to have such a father.
His voice was soft, reverent.
Reuven.
Yes.
I must ask you never to use such a method of explanation in my class.
He was speaking gently, almost apologetically.
I am myself not opposed to such a method, but I must ask you never to use it in my class. Do you understand me?
Yes.
I will call on you often now, he said, smiling warmly. Now that you understand, I will call on you very often. I have been waiting all year to see how good a teacher your father is. He's a great teacher and a great scholar. It is a joy to listen to you. But you must not use this method in my class, you understand?
Yes, I said again. And he dismissed me with a quiet smile and a gentle nod of his head. That evening, after my last class, I went to the school library and looked for Rav Gershenson's name in the Hebrew and English catalogues. His name wasn't listed anywhere. It was then that I understood why my father was not teaching in the school. Chapter 15. My father returned from the hospital in the middle of March. He was weak and gaunt, confined to his bed and almost completely incapable of any kind of physical activity. Manya cared for him as though he were a child, and Dr. Grossman visited him twice a week, on Mondays and Thursdays, until the end of April, when the visits were reduced to once a week. He was satisfied with my father's progress, he kept telling me. There was nothing to worry about anymore, except to make sure that he had complete rest. During the first 4 weeks my father was home, a night nurse came in every evening, stayed awake through the night in my father's room, then left in the morning. Talking tired him quickly. Even listening seemed to tire him. We weren't able to spend too much time together the first 6 weeks he was home. But it was wonderful to have him there, to know he was back in his room again and out of the hospital, and to know that the dark silence was finally gone from the apartment. I had told him about my experience with Rav Gershenson while he had still been in the hospital. He listened quietly, nodded, and had said that he was very proud of me. He hadn't said anything at all about Rav Gershenson. I was being called on regularly now in the Talmud class, and there were no silences when I read and explained a passage. I saw Danny all the time in school, but the silence between us continued. I had finally come to accept it. We'd begun to communicate with our eyes, with nods of our heads, with gestures of our hands, but we didn't speak to each other. I had no idea how he was getting along in psychology or how his family was, but I heard no bad news, so I assumed things were more or less all right. The grim faces of the teachers and the students in school reflected the newspaper headlines that told of Arab riots and attacks against the Jews of Palestine, Jewish defense measures, many of which were being hampered by the British, and continued Irgun activities. The Arabs were attacking Jewish settlements in the Upper Galilee, the Negev, and around Jerusalem, and were incessantly harassing supply convoys. Arabs were killing Jews, Jews were killing Arabs, and the British, caught uncomfortably in the middle, seemed unable and at times even unwilling to stop the rising tide of slaughter. The Zionist youth groups in the school became increasingly active, and on one occasion some of the members of my group were asked to cut our afternoon classes and go down to a warehouse in Brooklyn to help load uniforms, helmets, and canteens onto huge 10-ton trucks that were waiting outside. We were told that the supplies would soon be on a ship heading for Palestine and would be used by the Haganah. We worked long and hard, and somehow loading those trucks made me feel intimately bound up with the news bulletins that I kept hearing on the radio and seeing in the papers. In April, Tiberias, Haifa, and Safed were occupied by the Haganah, and the Irgun, with the help of the Haganah, captured Jaffa. My father was a good deal stronger now and had begun walking around a bit inside the house. We were able to talk at length, and we talked of little else but Palestine. He told me that before his heart attack, he'd been asked to go as a delegate to the Zionist General Council that was to meet in Palestine during the coming summer.
"Now I'll be glad if I can go to the cottage this summer," he said, and there was a wry smile on his lips.
"Why didn't you tell me?" I asked him. "I didn't want to upset you."
But I couldn't keep it to myself any longer. "So, I'm telling you now."
"Why didn't you tell me when they asked you?"
"They asked me the night I had the attack," he said. We never talked about it again. But if I was around, I always knew when he thought about it. His eyes would become dreamy, and he would sigh and shake his head. He had worked so hard for a Jewish state, and that very work now kept him from seeing it. I wondered often during the coming months what meaning he could possibly give to that. I didn't know, and I didn't ask him. We wept quite openly that Friday in the second week of May, when Israel was born. And on my way to the synagogue the next morning, I saw the newspaper headlines announcing the birth of the Jewish state. They also announced that the Arab armies had begun their threatened invasion. The next few weeks were black and ugly. The Etzion area and the Hebron Mountains fell. The Jordanian army attacked Jerusalem. The Iraqi army invaded the Jordan Valley. The Egyptian army invaded the Negev. And the battle for Latrun, the decisive point along the road to Jerusalem, turned into a bloodbath. My father became grim and silent, and I began to worry again about his health. In early June, a rumor swept through the school that a recent graduate had been killed in the fighting around Jerusalem. The rumor ran wild for a few days and was finally confirmed. I hadn't known him at all. He had graduated before I had entered, but apparently most of the present members of the senior class remembered him well. He'd been a brilliant mathematics student and very popular. He'd gone to the Hebrew University in Jerusalem to get his doctorate, had joined the Haganah, and been killed trying to get a convoy through to Jerusalem. We were stunned. We had never thought the war would come so close. On a day in the second week of June, the same week the United Nations truce went into effect and the fighting in Israel ceased, the entire school attended an assembly in memory of the student. Everyone was there, every rabbi, student, and college teacher. One of his Talmud teachers described his devoutness and dedication to Judaism. His mathematics professor talked about his brilliance as a student, and one of the members of the senior class told of the way he'd always spoken of going to Israel. Then we all stood as a prayer was chanted and the Kaddish was said. Reb Saunders' anti-Zionist league died that day, as far as the students in Hirsch College were concerned. It remained alive outside the school, but I never again saw an anti-Zionist leaflet inside the school building. The final examinations were not too much of a problem to me that semester, and I made all A's. July came and brought sweltering heat, and the happy announcement from Dr. Grossman that my father was now well enough to be able to go to the cottage in August and resume teaching in September. But he was to rest in the cottage, not work. Yes, he could write. Since when was writing work? My father laughed at that, the first time he'd laughed in months. In September, my father resumed his teaching, and I entered my third year of college. Since symbolic logic was part of philosophy, I'd chosen philosophy as my major subject, and I was finding it very exciting. The weeks passed quickly. My father was doing nothing but teaching for the first few months. Then, with the approval of Dr. Grossman, he went back to some of his Zionist activities and to teaching an adult class one night a week. The war in Israel continued sporadically, especially in the Negev. But the initiative had passed to the Israelis, and the tension was gone from it by now. Reb Saunders' anti-Zionist league seemed to have gone out of existence. I heard nothing about it, even in my own neighborhood. And one day, in the late spring of that year, while I was eating lunch, Danny came over to my table, smiled hesitantly, sat down, and asked me to give him a hand with his experimental psychology.
He was having difficulty setting up a graph for a formula involving variables. Chapter 16. I felt a little shiver hearing his voice. "Welcome back to the land of the living," I said, staring up at him and feeling my heart turn over. It had been over 2 years now that we hadn't talked to each other. He smiled faintly and rubbed his beard, which was quite thick. He was wearing his usual dark suit, tie-less shirt, fringes, and skullcap. His earlocks hung down along the sides of his sculptured face, and his eyes were bright and very blue. "The ban has been lifted," he said simply. "It feels good to be kosher again," I told him, not without some bitterness in my voice. He blinked his eyes and tried another smile. "I'm sorry," he said quietly. "I'm sorry, too. I needed you around for a while, especially when my father was sick." He nodded, and his eyes were sad. "How do you do it?" I asked. He blinked again.
"Do what?"
"How do you take the silence?" He didn't say anything, but his face tightened. "I hated it," I told him. "How do you take it?" He pulled nervously at an earlock, his eyes dark and brooding. "I think I would lose my mind," I said.
"No, you wouldn't," he said softly.
"You'd learn to live with it." "Why does he do it?" The hand pulling at the earlock dropped down to the table. He shook his head slowly.
"I don't know. We still don't talk."
"Except when you study Talmud, or he explodes." He nodded soberly.
"I hate to tell you what I think of your father."
"He's a great man," Danny said evenly. "He must have a reason."
"I think it's crazy and sadistic," I said bitterly. "And I don't like your father at all."
"You're entitled to your opinion," Danny said softly. "And I'm entitled to mine." We were silent for a moment.
"You've lost weight," I told him.
He nodded but remained silent. He sat there, slumped over, looking small and uncomfortable, like a bird in pain. "How are your eyes?" I asked. He shrugged. "They bother me sometimes. The doctor says it's nervous tension." There was another silence.
"It's good to have you back," I said, and I grinned.
He smiled hesitantly, his blue eyes bright and shining.
"You and your crazy way of hitting a baseball," I said. "You and your father with his crazy silences and explosions."
He smiled again, deeply now, and straightened up in the chair.
"Will you help me with this graph?" he asked.
I told him it was about time he helped himself with graphs, and then showed him what to do. When I told my father about it that night, he nodded soberly. He'd expected it, he said. The Jewish state was not an issue anymore, but a fact. How long would Reb Saunders have continued his ban over a dead issue?
"How is Danny feeling?" he wanted to know.
I told him Danny didn't look well and had lost a lot of weight. He was thoughtful for a moment. Then he said,
"Reuven, the silence between Danny and Reb Saunders..."
"It is continuing?"
"Yes." His face was sad. "A father can bring up a child any way he wishes," he said softly. "What a price to pay for a soul."
When I asked him what he meant, he wouldn't say anything more about it. But his eyes were dark. So Danny and I resumed our old habits of meeting in front of my synagogue, of riding to school together, eating lunch together, and going home together. Rav Gershenson's class became a particular joy because the ease between Danny and myself now permitted us to engage in a constant flow of competitive discussion that virtually monopolized the hours of the shiur. We dominated the class to such an extent that one day, after a particularly heated Talmudic battle between Danny and me that had gone on uninterrupted for almost a quarter of an hour, Rav Gershenson stopped us and pointed out that this wasn't a private lesson he was giving. There were 12 other students in the class. Didn't anyone else have something to say? But he said it with a warm smile, and Danny and I were delighted by his oblique compliment. A few days after we had resumed talking, Danny had told me that he had resigned himself to experimental psychology and was even beginning to enjoy it. When he talked about psychology now, he invariably used the technical language of the experimentalist. Variables, constants, manipulation, observation, recording of data, testing hypotheses, and the advantages of attempting to refute hypotheses as against confirming them. Mathematics no longer seemed to be much of a problem to him. Only rarely now did he need my help. We were sitting in the lunchroom one day when he told me of a conversation he had had with Professor Appleman. He said if I ever wanted to make any kind of valuable contribution to psychology, I would have to use scientific method. The Freudian approach doesn't really provide a method of accepting or rejecting hypotheses, and that's no way to acquire knowledge. Well, well, I grinned. Goodbye, Freud. He shook his head. No, it's not goodbye, Freud. Freud was a genius, but he was too circumspect in his findings. I want to know a lot more than just the things Freud dealt with. Freud never really did anything with perception, for example, or with learning. How people see, hear, touch, smell, taste, and learn is a fascinating subject. Freud never went into any of that. But he was a genius, all right, in what he did go into. You're going to become an experimentalist? I don't think so. I want to work with people, not with rats and mazes. I talked to Appleman about it. He suggested I go into clinical psychology. What's that? Well, it's the same as the difference between theoretical and applied physics, say. The experimental psychologist is more or less the theoretician. The clinical psychologist applies what the experimentalist learns. He gets to work with people. He examines them, tests them, diagnoses them, even treats them. What do you mean, treats them? He does therapy. You're going to become an analyst? Maybe. But psychoanalysis is only one form of therapy. There are many other kinds. What kinds? Oh, many kinds, he said vaguely. A lot of it is still very experimental. You're planning to experiment on people? I don't know. Maybe. I really don't know too much about it yet. Are you going on for a doctorate? Sure. You can't move into this field without a doctorate. Where are you planning to go? I don't know yet. Appleman suggested Columbia. That's where he got his doctorate. Does your father know yet? Danny gave me a tight, strained look. No. He said quietly. When will you tell him? The day I receive my smicha. Smicha is the Hebrew term for rabbinic ordination. That's next year, I said. Danny nodded grimly. Then he looked at his watch. We'd better move or we'll be late for the shiur, he said. We raced up the stairs to Rob Gershenson's class and made it just a moment before he called on someone to read and explain. During another one of our lunchroom conversations, Danny asked me what good symbolic logic was going to be for me when I entered the rabbinate. I told him I didn't know, but I was doing a lot of reading in philosophy and theology, and some good might come of that. I always thought that logic and theology were like David and Saul, Danny said. They are, but I might help them get better acquainted. He shook his head. I can't get over your becoming a rabbi. I can't get over your becoming a psychologist. And we looked at each other in quiet wonder. In June, Danny's sister was married. I was invited to the wedding and was the only one there who wasn't a Hasid. It was a traditionally Hasidic wedding, with the men and women sitting separately and with a lot of dancing and singing. I was shocked when I saw Reb Saunders. His black beard had begun to go gray, and he seemed to have aged a great deal since I had seen him last. I went over to congratulate him, and he shook my hand warmly, his eyes dark and piercing. He was surrounded by people, and we didn't have a chance to talk. I didn't care. I wasn't particularly eager to talk to him. Levy had grown up a little, but he still looked white-skinned, and his eyes seemed large behind his shell-rimmed glasses. Danny's sister had become a beautiful girl. The boy she married was a Hasid, with a black beard, long earlocks, and dark eyes. He looked rather severe, and I quickly decided that I didn't like him. When I congratulated him after the wedding and shook his hand, his fingers were limp and moist. When the school year ended and July came around, I went over to Danny's house one morning. Except for the wedding, I hadn't seen Reb Saunders at all since Danny and I had begun talking again, because my father was teaching me Talmud on Shabbat afternoons. So I decided it would be the polite thing to do to go over one morning after the school year. Danny took me up to his father's study. The third-floor hallway was crowded with dark kaftan men, waiting around in silence to see his father. They nodded and murmured respectful greetings to Danny, and one of them, an incredibly old man with a white beard and a bent body, reached out and touched his arm as we passed. I found the gesture distasteful. I was beginning to find everything connected with Reb Saunders and Hasidism distasteful. We waited until the person who was with his father came out. Then we went in. Reb Saunders sat in his straight-backed red leather chair, surrounded by books and the musty odor of old bindings. His face seemed lined with pain, but his voice was soft when he greeted me. He was, he said quietly, very happy to see me. He hesitated, looked at me, then at Danny. His eyes were dark and brooding. "Where was I keeping myself?" he asked. "And why wasn't I coming over anymore on Shabbos afternoons?" I told him my father and I were studying Talmud together on Shabbat. His eyes brooded and he sighed. He nodded vaguely. He wished he could spend more time talking to me now, he said, but there were so many people who needed to see him. Couldn't I come over some Shabbos afternoon? I told him I would try, and Danny and I went out. That was all he said. Not a word about Zionism, not a word about the silence he had imposed upon Danny and me, nothing. I found I disliked him more when I left than when I had entered. I didn't see him again that July.